apologetic and embarrassed. This is hardly the posture of success. As a result, you will fail to talk about your work, thus forfeiting the ever-present advertising opportunities that present themselves in ordinary social interaction. Feeling virtuous about what you do is an enormous advantage, and one that has been a part of Jewish tradition since time immemorial. Developing a deep conviction of the intrinsic morality and dignity of business injects vast power into any enterprise undertaken. There is a very real and practical reason that companies engage me to teach their executives and employees that the process and practice of business, although as vulnerable to misdeed as any other, is inherently dignified and moral. People who view themselves as ethical and virtuous are far less likely to step over a legal line than are people who feel that they are already deeply involved in improper conduct. Have you ever cheated on a diet to which you were committed? I know that I have, and I recall how much easier it was to raid the refrigerator the second time. I remember how I had vacillated back and forth 3 hours earlier. How could I ruin the good efforts of the past week? I had asked myself. My yearnings for that chocolate cream pie were strongly countered by the realization that if I yielded to temptation, I would be turning the entire previous week of discipline into a farce. That held me off for a while. But then my stomach enzymes began howling in chorus for just a taste of that chocolate cream pie. As my fevered imagination recalled the delicious taste, I blocked out the disturbing but ever weaker calls of my conscience, and, I am sorry to confess, I yielded. The delicious taste, I discovered, was tempered by the slightly bitter taste of failure. However, 3 hours later, when I found myself again lusting for just one more slice of the same pie, the voice of conscience was far weaker. After all, this time I would not be destroying a perfect record of disciplined restraint. I had already done that 3 hours earlier. What is one more little slice? Nothing, really. One more little slice is never very much when you already consider yourself to have been slicing off more than you ought to have. The Jewish principle underpinning this observation is found in Sayings of the Fathers. Ben Azai said, "Hasten to commit good acts and flee from misdeed, since every good act encourages another in its wake, while every misdeed eases the way to the next." This is one reason for the enormous emphasis that Judaism places on atonement. The origin of the word atone was when one viewed oneself as being at one with God. The annual observance of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, allows Jews to reset the odometer of one's moral self-evaluation back to zero, as it were. God can once again regard us as having been at one with Him. Turning over a new leaf and making a fresh start is enormously liberating. It allows one to recover one's morally driven self-restraint that might otherwise have eroded beyond the point of usefulness. Similarly, in business, everyone encounters numerous opportunities to slice off a piece of pie that would best be left alone. Everyone finds frequent opportunities to cross the line in pursuit of just a little more. Some businessman who sees himself as already a swindling rogue just by virtue of his occupation, a greedy business professional profiting by seizing the earnings of gullible fools, should have little trouble seizing just a little more. No, you are not a swindling rogue. In reality, you are a noble person providing for others in a marvelous environment that benevolently rewards you for your consideration. You may find yourself smiling at these words, But once you have overcome your skepticism, you will have taken a giant step toward increasing your revenue. Money is holy, and holidays are linked to money. Indeed, overcoming one's skepticism about the nobility of money seems to be an intrinsic part of the original divine plan for Jews, as reflected in some of the Jewish holidays. One Jewish holiday in particular seems to focus on money. Almost everyone knows that Jews observe Hanukkah by lighting candles on each of the 8 nights of the holiday. Far less familiar are 2 details concerning the celebration. 1. Part of the observance is for the light from those candles to have no utilitarian purpose. For this reason, they are customarily lit in a room in which other lighting, perhaps the regular electric lighting, is blazing. This allows the candles to serve their exclusive symbolic function and perhaps stimulate a discussion among family members. Someone may well ask, why do we have candles lit if there is already plenty of light in the room? Another may inquire, can we turn off the lights so we can see the candles better? 2. There is a custom of giving children monetary gifts on Hanukkah. Like other people, Jews enjoy giving gifts of various kinds on all sorts of occasions. For instance, on Purim, the Feast of Esther, people give gifts of food delicacies to one another. However, Hanukkah is the only holiday on which not only is it not distasteful to give a gift of money, but it is viewed quite positively, especially for children. These 2 quirks of observance are linked by their explanation. The definitive code of Jewish law, compiled in 1563 by Rabbi Joseph Caro of Safed in the Holy Land, emphasizes that absolutely no benefit should be obtained from using the light of the Hanukkah candles. Then, conjuring up what we ought surely to condemn as an anti-Semitic stereotype, the code declares, "And even to examine your money, and to count how much money you have may not be done by the light of the Hanukkah candles." What? And I suppose that on all other occasions on which Jews light celebratory candles, such as those that usher in the Sabbath each Friday night, the first thing they choose to do is count their money? Hardly. The point is that on Hanukkah you are supposed to be super sensitive to your money and particularly grateful for it. This is so central a feature of the Hanukkah holiday that you might have been forgiven for supposing that counting your money in front of the holiday candles would be a way of enhancing the link between Hanukkah and your money. Thus, the code of Jewish law warns that you must not count your money by the light of the candles, even though you might have imagined that especially on this holiday, that is exactly what you should do. You should certainly count your money on Hanukkah, just not by the light of those special candles. They have a special symbolism that is linked to the money, but just a little loftier. What does light symbolize to people? Well, if you aren't sure, take a glance at your Sunday comics and see what a light bulb shown above the head of one of the characters means. It usually suggests that Dagwood has just had a bright idea. That is why folks sometimes say, "I have seen the light," when what they really mean is, "Oh yes, I understand perfectly," or someone might ask the person to whom he is patiently explaining something, "Do you see?" In reality, Hanukkah candles are intended for only one purpose, and that is to signify education and understanding. Even the name of the holiday, Hanukkah, is an expansion of the Hebrew word for education. This word comprises the first 4 out of the 5 letters making up the Hebrew word Hanukkah. Yes, education and money are very closely linked, but who doesn't know that? Quite a few people in the United States today, it turns out. Joining together the themes of the candles and the money, we find the reason for the custom of giving children money for each of the 8 nights of Hanukkah in amounts that are proportional to the success of their studies. The money is a reward for the light they have gained during the past year. In this way, early in their development, children are inculcated with the idea that not only is money not bad, but it often can be a result of self-improvement. You receive money in proportion to how helpful you can make yourself to other people. Hanukkah is a reminder that educating oneself is surely one of the best ways of increasing one's potential to be helpful to others. Jews became bankers to help others, not as a last resort. In Western culture, the term moneylender has come to be an insult and an indictment. Obviously, people who view moneylending, banking, or finance as sleazy and unworthy occupations are hardly likely to engage in them, let alone flourish in them. By contrast, Jews always viewed putting one's capital at risk to enable someone else to make a profit as an honorable way to earn a living and to help others. The Jewish hierarchy of charity regards lending someone money to go into business as more noble than simply giving him the money. The latter condemns the recipient to be a beggar without enough self-respect to launch his or her own enterprise. However, lending money to a needy man elevates him into an independent businessman. This way, his dignity is preserved, and he retains the psychological self-image so necessary to conducting business successfully. There is a popular historic misconception regarding how Jews in medieval Europe found themselves reluctantly thrust into banking. The theory argues that Jews turned to finance because of oppression and anti-Semitism on the part of the locals, who denied Jews access to the various artisan guilds and other more desirable professions, such as farming. Left without alternative, claims this incorrect theory, Jews reluctantly turned to banking. In reality, this is not why Jews became bankers. In many enlightened Islamic countries during the same period, although there were few restrictions on Jewish occupations, Jews also found themselves engaged in banking and finance. Jews did not flee toward finance, they selected it at the outset. Although Jews were not driven into banking by anti-Semitism, there is, nonetheless, an interesting link between Jewish bankers and anti-Semitism, as Winston Churchill described in England at the end of the 13th century. In those days, when the greatest princes were pitifully starved in cash, there was, already in England, one spring of credit, bubbling feebly. The Jews had unseen and noiselessly lodged themselves in the social fabric of that fierce age. From time to time, they could be most helpful to personages in urgent need of money. This led the English Jews into a course of shocking imprudence. Land began to pass into the hand of Israel, either by direct sale or more often by mortgage. For some time past, there had been growing a wrathful reaction. Small landowners, oppressed by mortgages, spendthrift nobles who had made bad bargains, were united in their complaints. King Edward saw himself able to conciliate powerful elements and escape from awkward debts by the simple and well-trodden path of anti-Semitism. The Jews were held up to universal hatred, were pillaged, maltreated, and finally expelled from the realm. Not until 4 centuries had elapsed was Oliver Cromwell, by furtive contacts with a moneyed Israelite, to open again the coasts of England to the enterprise of the Jewish race. Debtors discovered an easy way to escape their obligations. It was simple. Get rid of the Jews. With the departing Jews went the inconvenient debts. It may not be a coincidence that in 1925 Adolf Hitler penned these words in his book Mein Kampf, in English My Struggle. The best way to know the Jew is to study the road he takes. He comes as a merchant, and with his thousand-year-old mercantile dexterity, he quickly becomes active in finance and economics, which soon become his monopoly. Certainly, Jews in Weimar Germany between the two world wars did dominate the fields of banking and finance. This may have had something to do with their subsequent fate in that blood-stained land. However, the comfortable relationship Jews enjoyed with banking was far older than the Weimar Republic. The most famous Jewish banking house in Europe was that of the Rothschilds. Its reason for success is illustrated by the story of Prince William of Hesse-Kassel, who, in the very early 1800s, needed to remain invisible while lending a large sum of money to the Danish court. Using Mayor Amschel Rothschild as an intermediary allowed the prince to remain anonymous. Denmark paid the interest regularly to Rothschild, who reliably transferred it to the prince. A few years later, Napoleon announced that the House of Hesse-Kassel would no longer exist. This conveniently meant that all money owed to the prince was to be paid to the French treasury. The French did not know the identity of the prince's debtors, but they suspected correctly that Rothschild did. Although they offered Rothschild a 25% commission on debts he collected and handed over, the old man remained scrupulously loyal to his royal client. Rothschild and his two sons surreptitiously traveled throughout Germany, collecting all the debts due to His Serene Highness. It was not because of anti-Semitism that Rothschild became a wealthy banker. It was because he acquired a reputation of utter trustworthiness. You see that although, historically, anti-Semitism may have been a consequence of Jewish domination of finance, it was hardly the cause. If it wasn't anti-Semitic oppression that drove Jews into banking, what was it? The main reasons that Jews found their way into the fields of finance were undoubtedly trustworthiness and their conviction that they were fulfilling a necessary need in society. When a merchant in Venice gave a sum of money to a local Jewish banker, the merchant could rest assured that his supplier in Amsterdam would receive the equivalent funds from another Jewish banker in Holland. What was so vital was that the two Jewish bankers trusted one another. It was this intangible system of trust that made commerce and wealth creation possible. But there was another reason, too. Both Christians and Muslims accepted a rather literal interpretation of the Bible's prohibition against charging interest to borrowers. This absolutist view effectively eliminated banking as a profession for the faithful of those religions. A Jewish understanding of the Bible, on the other hand, depends on what Jews refer to as the oral Torah, whose ecclesiastical authority fully matches that of its written counterpart. Jews believe that God taught the oral Torah to Moses during the 40 days he spent on the summit of Sinai. It is from the oral Torah the Jews were able to learn under exactly which circumstances God permitted interest to be levied against the loan, and precisely how that loan contract needed to be drawn. As a result, Jews felt no compunction about earning their livings by brokering and providing capital loans. On the contrary, they felt that they were providing a vital and valued service. Obviously, the field of banking, like any other field, presents its moral challenges. Some financiers have become notorious for extorting usurious rates of interest. But Judaism explicitly prohibits that kind of exploitation of unfortunate people. Some have violated the rules, but this indicts them alone and not the occupation. The fabulous profits that banking has generated for its many Jewish practitioners over the centuries came chiefly from Jews feeling that the profession was honorable and helpful to society. They were not only willing to become bankers, they were also proud and eager to do so. Gold is good. God said so. Judaism literally bequeaths wealth to its adherents by communicating moral enthusiasm for the profession of business. One can find the roots of Jewish conviction in the morality of business right at the start of the Torah. Almost any child raised in a home that took Jewish scholarship seriously would have studied the first few chapters of the Bible before his or her 10th birthday, and the message of those chapters lies deep in the Jewish psyche. During the 7 days of creation, the word good is used 7 times, as God brings various parts of the world into being and expresses profound satisfaction at how they came out, as it were. Amazingly, the 8th appearance of the word good is applied to nothing other than the eternal symbol of money. Gold. Right there, in the very beginning of the vast volume of the Torah, no more than 43 verses into the constitution of the Jewish people, gold, the ultimate medium of exchange, the metal of monetization, is described as good by God himself. As you can imagine, that verse not only made Jews very comfortable in the jewelry business, another profession where Jews have excelled in many countries, but the verse also established within the collective Jewish subconscious the idea that gold, a metaphor for money and wealth, is good. Although Jews have certainly experienced more than their fair share of poverty through the centuries, often arriving on new shores as penniless refugees, wealth was always seen to be a blessing. In a well-loved monthly prayer, regularly recited on the eve of each new moon, Jews feel quite comfortable asking God not only for health and peace, but also for prosperity. It is perfectly kosher to ask God for money. If you are comfortable with prayer, go ahead and include a request for prosperity in your prayers. What you are really asking for is the opportunity to serve your fellow human beings. The Talmud advises worshippers in the Jerusalem temple who wish to increase their wealth to pray facing the south, toward the direction of the table that held the ceremonial bread, because the bread was mystically linked to money. The mystical master and 13th century Kabbalist Nachmanides wrote of the ceremonial temple table and its showbread, "From the showbread upon the table came material blessings and economic abundance to all Israel." He described the bread as a sort of economic kickstart. Strangely enough, even today, the idea linking money and bread lingers with us as we colloquially refer to money as bread or dough. Deep within traditional Jewish culture lies the conviction that the only real way to achieve wealth is to attend diligently to the needs of others and to conduct oneself in an honorable and trustworthy fashion. Jews feel at ease blessing children each Sabbath with the words, "May God make you like Ephraim and like Manasseh." The oral Torah fills in the gaps by explaining that Ephraim represents spiritual steadfastness, and Manasseh represents economic creativity. The two belong together, and Jews wish their children to embody both. The Sabbath blessing to Jewish children continues with the biblical priestly blessing. May the Lord bless you and safeguard you. Again, the oral Torah, quoted by the authoritative commentator Rashi, as well as by the 19th century leader of German Jewry, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, explains the blessing to be for material wealth. The astounding news for the Jews was that God wants humans to be wealthy because wealth follows large-scale righteous conduct, which is His ultimate goal for His children. As Tevye the milkman puts it in the play Fiddler on the Roof, "I know it's no great shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either." In fact, the Bible emphasized the wealth of the patriarchs, and along with other requirements, being rich was necessary for being chosen as a prophet during biblical times. For instance, the Talmud records that not only did Moses himself possess enormous wealth, but so did most of the subsequent prophets of Israel. Rabbi Yochanan in the Talmud said, "God only allows His divine presence to rest on someone who is strong, wealthy, wise, and humble." The wise King Solomon said, "The crown of the wise is their wealth." And Jews have always understood that sentence to mean that God is happy with wise behavior and rewards it with wealth. Not only does the Bible commence with an account that includes God's warm and positive opinion of gold, but as you read further, you can see that the story about the origins of ancient Israel reaffirms the theme. Again, the Bible describes to its devotees the healthy outlook that legitimately acquiring money pleases God and is a positive experience. Ancient Israel as a nation had its beginnings in Egypt. Each Passover, Jews celebrate the Exodus from Egypt, highlighting the evening with the recitation of that escape. There is much emphasis on the haste in which they left the land of their subjugation. Hence, the unleavened matzahs that are eaten because there was no time for the bread to rise. Yet, in spite of their haste, it is clear that the ancient Israelites had ample time to take care of business. There may not have been time for bread to rise, but there was time for something far more important, obeying the Lord's instruction to Moses, "Let each Israelite request of the Egyptians silver and gold." Later, one reads, "The children of Israel carried out the word of Moses. They requested from the Egyptians silver, gold, and fabrics. The Egyptians granted their request, and they emptied Egypt." Formed in the crucible of hundreds of years of Egyptian slavery, ancient Israel finally experienced the Exodus, departing into the desert with sufficient gold and silver to later construct the tabernacle and to establish their own promised land. This theme, linking redemption and wealth, constantly reappears in Jewish culture. Money certainly isn't everything, but it mustn't be underrated either. In fact, it is a legitimate component of any divine redemption. It is no surprise that Jews have never been handicapped in business by feelings of moral confusion about money. I realize that the fact that Jews possess this extensive cultural reservoir affirming the morality of business is not necessarily of help to everyone. You might regard the Torah and its prescriptions as irrelevant to a modern business practitioner, certainly to a non-Jewish one. But my purpose has been merely to demonstrate how the Jewish people, throughout their often difficult history, derived real business effectiveness and economic power from possessing a deep conviction about business being an honorable profession. This is what allowed them, and indeed spurred them, to succeed. My task is to mark the path towards similar conviction for you. In my introduction, I said that you must be more than a mere reader. You need to be an active participant in your own redemption. You will need to walk your own path to conviction. The first marker on that path is to see most clearly how today's cultural forces defy your purpose. In that fashion, you will be able to design your own campaign to defeat those forces. Charity is good. Business is selfish. A popular misconception. As a business consultant, I spend considerable time in the offices of men and women who guide the destinies of great companies. On entering a client's office, I nearly always try to examine the plaques and testimonials on the wall. Among other citations, I have discovered awards from local Rotary clubs, photographs of hospitals to which my clients have donated funds, and thank yous for teaching classes to underprivileged youngsters. I make it a point to always identify at least one tribute that catches my eye. After studying it, I inquire about it in order to enjoy hearing the story behind the pictured benevolence. The business professionals are obviously proud of their philanthropic activity, and I believe suitably so. They can be cajoled into talking about their pet causes, and usually do so eloquently and passionately. But I have noticed that it is much easier to persuade business professionals to talk about the good they do outside the office than about the immeasurable good for society they do by running their businesses. For example, John Walton is a son of the late Sam Walton, the founder of the highly successful Walmart chain. John, himself high on the Forbes 400 list of wealthiest Americans, joined another tycoon, Theodore J. Forstman, founding partner of the investment banking concern Forstman Little, in setting up the Children's Scholarship Fund. This charity offers partial tuition scholarships for kindergarten through grade 12 to low-income families who want to send their children to a private school or educate them at home. The fund currently helps about 34,000 poor children in 47 states attend 7,000 private schools. Walton and Forstman are rightly proud of what they have achieved, and are not only attempting to vastly increase the fund's capacity to provide yet more scholarships, but also actively encouraging others to do the same thing. Seattle business professional and Jewish philanthropist Stuart Sloan has created and built several large and successful commercial enterprises, including the much-praised QFC regional supermarket company, of which he is the former chairman. In what is thought to be the largest gift to a single U.S. public school, Sloan is giving $1 million a year for 8 years to the T.T. Minor Elementary School in Seattle's central area. Sloan wanted to transform the long-neglected school by focusing on the whole child for the whole year, creating a year-round school with a strong academic program and enough staff to tackle issues that get in the way of learning. Stuart Sloan is justifiably proud of what he is doing. Do Walton, Forstman, and Sloan, and thousands of less well-known Good Samaritans feel the same pride about the good they do in their day-to-day activities? Tens of thousands of people are able to take care of their families because they have a good job at Walmart. In addition, millions of U.S. families acquire their household needs at fair and advantageous prices. Under Ted Forstman's leadership, Gulfstream developed the new ultra-long-range business jet, the Gulfstream 5, which not only enabled people to travel faster and accomplish more, but also provided jobs and security to thousands of workers. I hope he feels as much pride in the success of the Gulfstream Aerospace Corporation as he does in the Children's Scholarship Fund he started. He ought to. Those accomplishments are praiseworthy. Is Sloan as proud of the good he has done helping people through his commercial activities as he is of his achievements at the T.T. Minor Elementary School? More to the point, do the vast majority of Americans understand and appreciate what business contributes to their well-being. Do you feel the same pride in the good you accomplish merely by running your business as you do in the civic and charitable work you do? You can't earn an honest living without pleasing others. Here's another example. I knew a young woman who made a fairly good living for herself and her daughter as a pharmaceutical company representative. She visited doctors' offices and introduced the caregivers to her company's new medications. She often would relate to me the sheer terror she felt on walking into a doctor's office in her sales district. Then one day, while visiting her office, I overheard her on the phone. She sounded brutal. First she begged, and then she threatened. She obviously wasn't going to take no for an answer. After a few minutes, she hung up the phone with a triumphant grin. "Got him for $1,000," she crowed. It turned out that she was raising funds for breast cancer research. When I asked her why she felt so much more comfortable browbeating a contractor into a donation than a doctor into a pharmaceutical purchase, her shocking answer was, "But this is for a good cause." Few people can truly excel at occupations about which they entertain moral reservations. That woman was convinced that raising money for medical research was good and worthy, while selling pharmaceuticals was selfish. It made her uneasy. When asked about her occupation, she tried to disguise it as something other than what it was. However, she frequently related how much money she had raised for charity. Why would she never have considered boasting about the commission she earned the previous month? She was shocked when I suggested to her that her monthly commission check was a measure of how helpful she had been to the doctor, his patients, her own company, and the hundreds of other employees of her company who depended on her sales efforts. Deep down, she must have felt that selling medicine clearly did nothing for anyone else. She might even have suspected that she was helping her company earn the kind of obscene profits that television pundits constantly condemn. She had no confidence that her method of earning a living was more moral than that of a snake oil salesman of yesteryear. Deep down, she did not believe that she was doing the doctor and his patients a favor, while at the same time, of course, benefiting herself. Consider this final example. A rabbinic colleague recently consulted with me. He wanted to know whether I thought he could augment his income by joining a multi-level marketing company in which his neighbor had been trying to interest him. I asked him if he understood what it would really entail on a practical level. I saw him shift uneasily from foot to foot for a moment before answering. He would have to try to lure all his friends, relatives, and associates, making them consumers and distributors of his products, he explained. He saw himself as using his friends to further his own self-interest. It did not occur to him that he might just be the same answer to their dreams as his sponsor was to his own aspirations. It was clear to me that he would approach people as a supplicant, not as a benefactor. My answer to him was that although many succeed, some brilliantly, in multi-level marketing companies, he was unsuited to the enterprise. Those who do succeed are filled to the brim with passion, enthusiasm, and conviction. I reasoned that my rabbinic friend's demeanor and his very words indicated to me that he would feel uncomfortable involving his social circle in his business endeavors. I told him that it seemed to me as if he thought he would be exploiting them. He nodded his assent. Continuing, I explained that unless he was capable of believing that by involving his friends and relatives he was doing them the biggest favor imaginable, he should best seek an alternative avenue of enrichment. To really succeed in whatever is the business of your choice, you have to come to understand and utterly absorb into your being the fundamentally true idea that your activities in your business are virtuous and moral provided, of course, that you conduct your business affairs honestly and honorably. Absorb this lesson into your heart and into your soul, and you will have overcome a major hurdle on your road to financial achievement. You must respect the dignity and the morality of business. This is one of the most important reasons why Jews have enjoyed economic success over the generations, and it is one that, regardless of your own background, you can use, too. You will just need to find your own way to seeing the beauty and the nobility in how you earn your living. It is far more than merely seeing yourself as an honest and good person. You must come to see that part of your goodness, part of the benefit you bring to others, is your daily conduct in operating your business enterprise. Whether you work in forestry, pharmaceuticals, or other industries that incur the wrath of the culture, whether you make widgets or run a small flower shop, you must understand the nobility inherent in going to work each day. The rule is that people seldom excel at any occupation that deep down they consider unworthy. And even if they are neutral about the morality of business, that neutrality is a weak reed on which to build success. How we are all persuaded that business is evil. If at this point you are wondering how anyone could feel that making money is immoral, let me assure you that everyone is subtly influenced by the culture surrounding us. More and more, that culture has been beaming out a high negative view of business and business people. Even the pro-business High and Lois cartoon presupposes that Lois's son has never been exposed through school, reading, or television to the shocking idea that business professionals like his dad can be heroic. Increasing numbers of Americans view wealth not as the morally legitimate rewards of risk, innovation, and effort, but as an unjust and morally suspect outcome. So pervasive is the message that almost nobody is completely immune to its insidious effects, and it comes from a broad cross-section of sources: education, the media, even business professionals themselves. How we are taught that business is bad from early education. It is sad that everyone seems to have been conditioned to moral skepticism regarding business. Imagine watching a high school teacher asking each of her students in turn to tell the class what career path they were interested in selecting and the reasons why. One boy stands up and announces, "I want to become an environmental consultant so I can ensure clean air and water for all." Everyone cheers. The next student informs the class that she wants to become a medical researcher in order to find a cure for AIDS. Everyone applauds wildly. Another student reveals that his dream is to become a teacher so that I can help poor youngsters step on to the elevator of the American dream. Everyone gasps in admiration at the idealism of the future educator. Finally, the last girl is asked of her plans. She furrows her brows for a few moments, and then slowly and clearly says, "I want to become a highly successful business executive, so I can improve the world and make a difference in many people's lives." I think that in most schools, guffaws of raucous laughter would greet this perfectly reasonable statement. This is not such an imaginary lesson. Between 1990 and 1995, Germany lost nearly 500,000 jobs. Although some of the economic battering experienced by the Germans during this period might be attributable to costs incurred in the reunification of East and West Germany, the German weekly magazine Wirtschaftswoche presented a different explanation. It claimed that the sad economic performance of the country whose industry gave the world the term economic miracle was due to Germany's educational establishment spending the previous three decades teaching kids that money is a bad thing. Wirtschaftswoche surveyed the country and revealed that 40% of Germans say they regard entrepreneurs as exploiters, up from 17% since the last poll in 1965. They discovered that a majority of 16 to 19-year-olds, presumably an age group ready for risks, says no thanks to the idea of starting a business. The older age groups who attended school prior to those years and escaped the educational anti-business indoctrination showed far more enthusiasm for entrepreneurial activity. When organizations, countries, or companies allow themselves to believe that making money lacks social value, they should not be surprised to see their economic performance decline. The same holds true for individuals. Movies and television conspire to make you poor. In his book, Hollywood vs. America, my longtime friend Michael Medved wrote that prior to 1965, television shows portrayed businessmen as good guys twice as often as bad guys. This ratio was reversed in the 1970s, when audiences were treated to two business villains for every good guy. Medved points out that during Hollywood's golden age in the 1930s and 1940s, businessmen frequently appeared in a highly sympathetic light. In the 1933 George Cukor classic Dinner at Eight, Lionel Barrymore played a decent and dignified shipping magnate, struggling to keep his company afloat. And in the cherished family film It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart's character, George Bailey, is a humane, compassionate, and likable banker. Today, the very idea of a likable banker has become unthinkable. Big business has become the media's favorite villain. This evolution was noted by business columnist Daniel Seligman in his Forbes magazine article, Tom Cruise versus Corporate Evil. Seligman wrote that the movie Mission Impossible 2, the number one movie of summer 2000 in 25 countries, was also the new number one prototypical anti-business movie. Mission Impossible 2's villains set up an elaborate scheme to get rich off stock options, to be a little more precise, at which point Seligman wrote, "We know we are dealing with ultimate evil." An exhaustive analysis of primetime television by sociologists Robert Lichter, Linda Lichter, and Stanley Rothman concluded, "Clearly, the business of TV's businessmen is crime. In fact, this is the only occupational group on television that is disproportionately involved in crime. Even television children get the message that business professionals are evil." Lichter, and Rothman described an episode of Different Strokes, in which two brothers go into business selling brownies. After accepting an order too large for their fledgling business to fulfill, they enlist the help of their sister. Instead of accepting her wish to be made a full partner in their business, they offer her a meager salary as their employee. "That's what business is all about," the boys tell her. "You do the work, and we get the profits." Journalist Mark Gunther put it this way. "Power-crazed media moguls blackmail members of Congress. An agribusiness giant poisons an Indian reservation. A famed Texas CEO hires a hitman to gun down his ex-girlfriend." If you missed these stories from the world of commerce, you haven't been watching television lately. They're examples of an unmistakable trend, the rise of corporate villainy in prime time. In one television episode of Walker, Texas Ranger, the CEO of a fictional agri-feed company foists an untested animal feed additive onto a Native American reservation, murders his corporate counsel, wipes out dozens of Native Americans, and sends in a private army to cover up the mess. "Billions in future profits for the lives of a few Cherokees," the CEO sums up. How about the 1997 fact-based movie called Two Voices, about two women who heroically exposed the danger of silicone breast implants? Forget about a fictional villain. This cable television movie demonized a real corporation, Dow Corning, which the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and the Justice Department had investigated and exonerated. Dow, it turned out, had indeed disclosed all known safety risks associated with implants. Furthermore, mainstream science has now debunked the central claim that silicone implants cause terrible diseases. In the movie With an Agenda, one of the noble heroines asked, "How do these guys at Dow Corning sleep at night?" Her husband helpfully explained, "Dow is like any other corporate entity. Their board answers to the stockholders." For further evidence, peruse a special report on television, TV programming, from the Media Research Center in Alexandria, Virginia, whose researchers watched a mind-numbing 863 sitcoms, dramas, and TV movies broadcast by ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox. The researchers' findings: business people tend to be portrayed as venal and unscrupulous. They engage in criminal behavior. As a group, corporate types commit more murders on TV than any other occupational category, even career criminals. Heroic CEOs, meanwhile, are scarce. You see lawyer heroes and cop heroes. But it's hard to do a TV show about job creation or investment, laments Tim Lamer, co-author of the report titled Businessmen Behaving Badly. In Michael Pack's brilliant made-for-PBS public broadcasting system special, Hollywood's favorite heavy, Businessmen on Primetime Television, one screenwriter, Philip Daguerre, creator of the television series Simon and Simon, admitted that not only had he been making villains of business people, but that he was going to do more of it. He wasn't done. It's something that everybody can identify with, and is consequently probably pretty close to the truth, he said. The narrator of Hollywood's favorite heavy, Eli Wallach, noted that corporate executives on TV seem to make an awful lot of money without ever having to work hard or produce useful products. To succeed, all they seem to do is lie, cheat, blackmail, even murder. In one of his articles decrying the popular culture's tendency to demonize business professionals, journalist and author Michael Fumento pointed out that business people are portrayed as greedy. "Greed, for a lack of better word, is good," proclaimed corporate raider Gordon Gekko in Oliver Stone's Wall Street. This is Hollywood's vision of the businessman. And whether it's on the big screen or on the boob tube, businessmen applying Gekko's vision of the world regularly shoot, slash, poison, blackmail, extort, and smear their way to the top. And businessmen, Hollywood style, aren't getting any better. In the second Aliens movie, Sigourney Weaver's character, Ripley, accuses the representative of the otherwise unnamed entity, the Company, of sending 157 colonists to a horrible death, of being cocooned and ripped apart by vicious alien creatures. The representative simply replies that it was a bad call. Later he tries to block the attempt of other people in his party to avoid hand-to-hand combat with the aliens by going into orbit and blasting the planet, explaining that along with the aliens, they would be destroying a facility with a significant dollar value. Finally, he attempts to have Ripley and a little girl impregnated with the horrible alien embryos, in order to slip the alien creatures past quarantine and be rewarded by the company. Back here in the 20th century, the Washington-based Media Institute has found that by the age of 18, the average TV viewer has seen businessmen attempt more than 10,000 murders and countless lesser offenses, all in the name of greed. And although Wall Street represents the go-go 1980s, and even though Aliens 2 is not a recent film, this trend continues. Playing to the culture's anti-business mood, Hollywood continues to routinely cast business professionals negatively. Wall Street, Boiler Room, Tomorrow Never Dies, and 2002's summer hit movie Spider-Man features business moguls as villains. It is difficult to think of movies or TV shows that depict business professionals as heroic or even morally neutral. You might remember the hilarious and popular hit Trading Places, starring Eddie Murphy, that Paramount Pictures made in 1983. The villains of the piece were two brothers, businessmen who ran a large securities and commodities trading company. They were depicted as a pair of heartless, racist, swindling tycoons. In general, our entertainment establishment seems intent on portraying those who successfully earned their living in business as evil, psychotic, or both. Listen to Vanity Fair columnist Christopher Hitchens. At least, in fiction and in motion pictures, the businessman is most commonly cast as a villain. In the movies, the instant the camera pans up the towering and glittering skyscraper, you just know that there is a corporate villain lurking on the top floor. Perhaps you are saying to yourself, who cares what entertainment shows? Everyone knows that the movies are fiction. We can't help believing some of what people tell us. Let me tell you a Bible story from the second book of Samuel that you may never have heard. Its entire purpose is to educate the Bible reader to this one simple and inescapable fact. You cannot help believing some of what people tell you. Once, on a time, a long while ago, in a far-off land, there lived a great and good king called David. When he was not winning wars or growing his nation's economy, he was composing beautiful music and writing the book of Psalms. God was so proud of him that he decreed that the future messianic line would descend from his favorite ruler, David. Many years earlier, long before he became king, David had a dear friend, Crown Prince Jonathan, who was the son of King Saul. Although King Saul made several attempts on the life of David, whom he rightly saw as his son's rival for the crown, David's affection for Jonathan never wavered. And although Jonathan knew he would never be king after his father, he displayed no petulance and loved his old friend as before. Not surprisingly, the names Jonathan and David became synonymous with true friendship. After the collapse of the royal house of Saul, instead of executing his former enemies as was the charming custom of the day, David was careful to treat all the now unemployed appointees and officials of Saul's court with dignity and magnanimity. "Are there any survivors of the house of Saul for me to rescue and help, for the sake of my old friend Jonathan?" asked King David. A fellow by the name of Ziva informed the king that an infirm son of Jonathan had survived. David summoned the poor cripple, Mephibosheth, for whom Ziva was now working, and said, "Don't be afraid. I will deal kindly with you for the sake of your late father Jonathan. I will restore you the entire estate that belonged to your grandfather, King Saul, and you will always be welcome in my palace." You can imagine how relieved and grateful Mephibosheth must have felt toward the new king, and he pledged eternal loyalty to his benefactor. Soon after David became king of Israel, his own son Absalom launched a rebellion. Messengers came to David with the news that large numbers of the population had joined Absalom. Aware of his son's ruthlessness, David assembled his loyalists and called out, "Arise, let us flee. There will be no escape or mercy from Absalom." Unbeknown to David, as an act of loyalty, Mephibosheth tried to accompany the king, but was hindered by his handicap. Instead, he sent his employee Ziva to transmit his pledge of support. A day or two later, while on the run, David spotted the crafty old courtier. Calling to him, David asked Ziva how his boss, Mephibosheth,